This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In 1620, the Wampanoag, the people of the First Light, already knew that their land was a land of plenty. But for Edward Winslow, one of the Mayflower pilgrims who dropped anchor off what's now Provincetown on November 11th, 1620, Massachusetts eventually became a land of almost unimaginable abundance. All the springtime, the earth sendeth forth naturally very good salad herbs, Winslow wrote. A profusion of grapes, native strawberries, gooseberries, and three sorts of plum, he wrote back to England. And then there were the mussels, the oysters, fish and fowl we have in great abundance, he said. Fresh cod, too. In September, we can take a hogshead of eels in a night. Well, the largesse of the Wampanoag, of course, saved the pilgrims on the very first Thanksgiving. Edward Winslow was just 25 when he arrived on the Mayflower, and he went on to become governor of Plymouth Colony. Winslow's writing shows us also that the pilgrims were a group of ambitious radicals from the start. His diaries and letters form the heart of Rebecca Fraser's new history. It's called The Mayflower: The Families, the Voyage, and the Founding of America. And Rebecca Fraser joins us now from Argo Studios in New York. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
So here you are speaking to Boston, which seems to be rather appropriate given the subject of your book.
Yes.
Why is it that you wanted to write about the families on the Mayflower?
Well, I was very excited at the idea that this is really the beginning of modern democracy, that the Mayflower people are carrying a sort of democratic version of parliamentary democracy from England to America. Of course, that's a sort of romantic notion, but there are elements of that in that they write something called the Mayflower Compact, which doesn't have a monarch involved. So it's a consensual agreement, probably the first one in the Western world. So I was sort of interested in people who didn't like England. I'd written a history of England, which was really about waves of immigration of people coming to England. I was passing at the house where John Winthrop lived, mm-hmm. near Groton in England. And I suddenly thought, what about people who didn't like England, who left? And I was very sort of fascinated by American democracy.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So then let's talk about some of those people. Tell us about the Winslows.
Well, the Winslows come from the sort of background that produced Shakespeare. I mean, they're a dynamic merchant family from Worcestershire. Worcestershire is a big growth area because of Droitwich. We'd had salt deposits, which were very important because of the transformation of procedures in dyeing in the cloth industry. So Droitwich, which is where the Winslows come from, and Worcester, which is where Edward Winslow is educated, are boom towns. They're full of rich, dynamic people. And the Winslows are sort of good middle-class yeoman family. But Edward Winslow himself is apprenticed to be a printer, and he gets to London, and the printer he falls in with also imports illegal Puritan literature from Holland. And Edward Winslow, who's come from a pretty ordinary Church of England background, gets captivated by the idea of criticising the government. He doesn't believe there should be bishops in the English Church. And so he leaves and goes to Holland to be part of the Puritan illegal press.
What it sounds like, if I may use some modern language here, that Edward Winslow was radicalised by Puritan literature from Holland.
Yes, no, totally, totally. It is a sort of radicalisation process.
Oh, so can you just tell me in a little bit more detail what specifically was in the literature? I mean, was it an anti-monarchist literature or anti-Church of England?
What it was a criticism that the reformation of the Church of England or the creation of the Church of England had not gone far enough in reformation terms. Scholars, because of Renaissance, they were able to relook at texts of the ancient church. They started learning Greek again. And they come to this conclusion that there were no bishops in the ancient church in Palestine. And this has this extraordinary effect. People become really obsessed by the idea that there shouldn't be this hierarchy. And hierarchies are very much associated with the papacy, with Rome, with corruption. And there's this drive to create a purer, better church. And out of that, you either try and reform the Church of England from within, which many Puritans did, who in fact came and settled Boston, or you create a separatist church in which you just have elders and you don't have the King of England as head of it, But that, of course, was illegal, and that's why they had to flee to Holland.
I see. Okay, so the Winslows then go to Holland, but what triggers their decision to make the trek to the New World?
Leiden in Holland has become this centre for Protestant printing of all kinds, because Holland is waging a war against the Spanish Empire, and so they welcome all manifestations of Protestant culture, Protestant literature. But there's been a truce for 12 years and it is coming to an end. So this church and the printing press is no longer going to be able to function, and they're either going to have to go back to England or stay in Holland, which they don't like because they're all being worked to the bone by Dutch clothing manufacturers, basically. And so the New World beckons to them. This is going to be a place of freedom where they're going to be able to have their own kind of religion. And also they're living in Holland at a time when there are lots of Dutch people around talking about the fact that the Dutch have begun exploring North America, that they have, in quotes, discovered Hudson's River.
Okay. So then how is it that the family connects with the Mayflower then?
Well, the Mayflower is a ship hired by this little separatist church in Holland, started by a nonconformist minister who has been expelled from England, John Robinson, and William Brewster. And William Brewster, in order to earn money, is tutoring the children of wealthy Dutch merchants. And he has also started this another printing press. And he is printing Puritan literature, which is smuggled back into England. And so they are making money in this way. And Edward Winslow works for William Brewster and then gets caught up by the church. He marries a member of the church. And they are all deciding to quit, to go to North America. Also, he's been a printer in London, and one of the growth areas of publishing at that time is in narratives about the New World. And I think Edward's very excited about this because he's actually been in London when Pocahontas visits James I and is entertained as the daughter of an emperor. So Native Americans are an object of enormous fascination at that point.
So, Rebecca, if I may just Your description there of Edward Winslow challenges a number of sort of common held stereotypes about the Puritans, right? I mean, first of all, it seems as if Edward Winslow, since he had gone to Holland, that he wasn't necessarily escaping English persecution, right? Because things were all right at Holland if it hadn't been for the changes in the printing world, as you were discussing. Second of all, it also didn't sound like he was terribly impoverished. And third of all, I'm fascinated to hear that he was attracted by the idea of a burgeoning market in New World narratives, right? Because that sort of entrepreneurial market-seeking aspect of the Puritans is not one that we ever think about when commonly considering their history.
Of course, Edward Winslow is someone who, one of his most famous phrases is that New England is a place where profit and religion can jump together. So I think that he is excited by the New World because he's very informed. He is more informed than the other pilgrims about what lies ahead. But they are all very excited about what they're going to be able to do. And they think they are going to make money. Actually, they think they're going to make money by fishing. But I think there's a misconception about the Mayflower pilgrims that they were all very impoverished. They were impoverished as a result of having to go and live in Leiden and leave their farms, leave good jobs, leave lovely houses, in Edward Winslow's case, a very comfortable job. So they came from very, you know, sort of educated backgrounds. I mean, what's interesting to me is that On the Mayflower is an etiquette book. There are books of political science. But this, in the past, has rather been lost, and it's assumed that they're not tremendously educated. What they are is they were religious refugees in Holland who have, you know, it's the plight of many immigrants. They have lost a lot of their past. They're having to start again in America.
And, you know, they were very worldly, even following their arrival in the quote-unquote New World. I'm just thinking of a conversation I had several years ago with Boston's former city archaeologist, and she was describing to me how they had done a dig in a late 17th century privy that they had discovered in Boston. And the privy was full of lace and olive pits and things like that, items that you wouldn't necessarily associate with isolated religious radicals who had no contact, with the trade flowing around the rest of the world, and yet they did. So,
yes. I mean, I think that what people forget is how quickly trade expands between the New World and the rest of the world, so that by the late 17th century, Boston is really a thriving city with a tradition of beautiful portrait painting, furniture, and it's become a tremendous sort of entrepot, really. Mm. But it's very quick. Its rise is tremendously quick.
Yeah. So we are getting ahead of ourselves a little bit, though, because I want to ask you about the passage on the Mayflower, because a lot of your work is actually based on Winslow's own writings. Well, what did he write about the voyage itself?
He had to write, or rather the pilgrims had to write an account of the voyage to send it back to the City of London investors who were going to send more money after them. He said this is how people felt that the wind was coming north-northeast. One of the masts collapses, that they think they're going to have to go back, that there are 100-foot waves, that the sailors are very unpleasant to them and say they're all going to die, that one of the sailors does die, two babies are born, one of whom is called Oceanus. And then one is born in Provincetown when they land. And so it's a very vivid contemporary account.
Wow. I am, again, endlessly fascinated by the fact that they were writing in order to... It's like a quarterly corporate report in order to get investors to send more money.
So true.
Tell me honestly what the writings and the research that you have done for this book, tell us about how much the Puritans did owe their initial survival upon their arrival, on the shores of New England, to the native people who were already here.
Well, I think they owed absolutely everything, in that the voyage was very ill-prepared for, because they had to be secretive, because they were religious. They were sort of regarded as illegal separatists. And they didn't really have time to sort of take the sort of stores with them that they would need. And they also have been delayed. So they come to New England now. And it's too late in the season. And they need food. And the Wampanoag people are generous, benevolent. They show them Native American agricultural techniques. They show them where to fish. They are generous with their time. And it is a very symbiotic relationship. I mean, in fact, truly, Thanksgiving reflects a very happy moment which lasts for about 14 years between Plymouth and the Wampanoags. Huh. And in fact, lasts really for most of the century.
Yeah. And I mean, it is remarkable that the initial relationship was so symbiotic because, factually speaking, every colonist who arrived was a colonist, right? They were there seeking to establish control over lands that were already owned and populated by the native people of New England. So it does, I find it endlessly interesting that the Wampanoag's initial response was not one of hostility.
Well, I think they were much more powerful. I mean, the people of the Mayflower, there are only 50 of them. They are ill. Are they going to survive the winter? And they're ignorant. And so they were vulnerable people. And Plymouth were quite exceptional as colonists in that they wanted to know what their relationship to the land was. They should be buying this off the native people. And in fact, they get Roger Williams to do a sort of paper about who really owns the land, who are the ultimate owners of the land, and who should they compact with in order to own the land. And this is sort of in the late 1620s, early 1630s. So I don't think they are colonists in the sense of sort of imperialists. I think they are genuinely wanting to get to know these fascinating Native Americans about whom a great deal has been written already.
Right. And as you note, the Wampanoag probably just have this, had an incredible degree of sympathy and humanity for the starving Puritans that just washed up on their shore.
Absolutely.
What kind of relationship specifically did Edward Winslow have with the Wampanoag chief Massasoit?
Well, he had a very special relationship in that he saved Massasoit's life, and he actually gave him chicken soup, which may have a sort of what we would regard as a natural antibiotic in it. But whatever it is, this makes a big difference. But he has already reached out to Massasoit in a way which is really unusual. He had a great relationship with him. And in fact, John Winthrop, when he arrives in Boston or creates Boston in 1634, he writes about this wonderful relationship between Edward Winslow and what he calls his old ally, Massasoit. So it's very noticeable to people coming from England that there is this great relationship between Plymouth and the Wampanoag.
Yeah. One last question. This is absolutely a fascinating history because I think, you know, the story of the Pilgrims in the United States is, of course, one that every school child learns, but we do learn that overly simplified version of the funny hats and the belt buckles and that first Thanksgiving. The truth of their experience and the impact that they had, positive and negative, here in New England is so interesting. I just wonder what you think is important about us, you know, knowing that level of detail about them today. Why should we know it?
Well, it was turned into a foundation myth, really, by Abraham Lincoln saying that Thanksgiving is going to be a national holiday, which is the original origin of Thanksgiving. But it was viewed as an instrument of reconciliation. And so I think it is very interesting to see the sort of the truth behind myths. You know, is there a truth? Was there a warmth between all the many different peoples in North America? And I would say, you know, there were extremely good intentions on both sides at the beginning. And I think that's reflected in the Thanksgiving feast.
Yeah. Unfortunately, all that changed later on with King Philip's War, didn't it?
But I think there's definitely 40 good years of peace between Plymouth and the Wampanoags.
Well, the new book is The Mayflower, The Families, The Voyage, and The Founding of America. It's by Rebecca Fraser. It's been a true pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you. Very nice to speak to you.
Well, we mentioned King Philip's War there. In 1675, colonial militia fought the Narragansett and Metacom, chief of the Wampanoag, and son of Massasoit, the chief who had welcomed Edward Winslow and the Pilgrims in 1620. King Philip's War was a terrible, bloody war. I mean, for example, Governor Josiah Winslow, Edward's son, burned down native villages as he marshaled the colonial militia toward Rhode Island Territory. So it's a stark reminder that while modern Thanksgiving is a day of gratitude, it is also one of loss. Every Thanksgiving Day, since 1970, a group of Native Americans gathers in Plymouth to mark what they call a National Day of Mourning. But for Ramona Peters, there is also pride. She is the Tribal Historic Preservation Officer for the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe.
Once you focus on the history and you, if you know it, there's a lot of grief and mourning for our losses of our people, our land, our clean water, oceans. There's a lot of things that we've lost, continue to lose. I know when in my warrior days of young adulthood, I was angry and confused about why our ancestors did that, and it was a big mistake, and it impacted all tribes across the country, in the Pacific Rim, everywhere. I was angry and confused and embarrassed about my ancestors, and it was totally wrong. As I grew older, and I realized that we should never be ashamed of being friendly and hospitable. Sure, I mean, I've been quoted as saying we could have wiped them out on the beach, but I don't feel that way anymore. I'm very proud that this country celebrates Thanksgiving. It's a very good thing. I think it is important at times like this right now for us to really look at what we have and the life that we, the luxury and the life that we live, especially when we begin to have fears of the future, to really look at what we have and you know, experience that gratitude. I think it's good medicine for us.
Ramona Peters, Tribal Historic Preservation Officer for the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.